Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'll never forget my first week. I had a sit down at the Four Seasons in Manhattan, a meeting with Darren Dean, and we started talking about bringing Thierry in. And that's the first week. And I'm this kid from Williamsport, Pennsylvania, that knows nothing.
My name is Sebastian Alvarado, and I'm the host of this long-form interview-style podcast where each week I sit down with some of the most interesting and influential people involved in the game. The purpose of these conversations is to dig deep and get to know the person behind the title. In this week's episode, I sit down with Eric Stover, the Chief Operating Officer of the New York Cosmos. He's one of the most prominent sports executives in the country with a career spanning over 20 years. He takes us through his career journey from the humble beginnings in Pennsylvania, from the day he decided to pack the car and leave for an unpaid internship at the Meadowlands, to becoming the New York Red Bulls team president at only 35 years old, to where he is today, running and overseeing the Cosmos. This is the amazing inside story of someone who has helped shape an industry and a game he had very limited knowledge of that day at the Four Seasons when he was set to negotiate an MLS deal for Thierry Henry. I hope you enjoy it. Eric, welcome to the Coffee and Football Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
How you doing?
Very good.
Since the theme of this pod is coffee and football, How do you drink your coffee?
I don't drink coffee. I had a traumatic experience back to Little League. Tried to chug hot coffee when I was 12 years old on a 95-degree day, thinking it was water. So I don't drink coffee. I drink tea. And unlike most Americans, with a little bit of milk in it.
For someone who doesn't know you or doesn't have much of a relation to soccer, how would you introduce yourself and what it is that you do?
That's a good question. It's kind of hard to explain sometimes. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Cosmos. Pelé is the honorary president, so he's got that title. And at the end of the day, everything flows through me, including the sporting side, to our board of directors, our owners. So everything from ticket sales to marketing to legal fees and player transactions, everything ultimately comes through me. The way we try to run it with the Cosmos is Giovanni Savarese is our head coach and sporting director. Wonderful, outstanding guy. Passion and vision for where we want to take this club. And so when it comes to player transactions, for the most part, he's responsible, consults with me on things. At the end of the day, we're both responsible for the budget. But he handles most contract negotiations. When we get to a different level, with something like Raul, with signing Raul, he did all the legwork, the recruiting, established sort of the parameters of where this would go. And then it became my job to convince the board that, you know, this is a good move. And quite often with those bigger deals, at the end of the day, the contract negotiation will fall to me. So it's a bit of the football side of things, the soccer side of things, and all the business.
It sounds like it's quite a bit of multitasking. How do you grasp that? How do you remain focused and how do you prioritize when you have so many things that come funnels through you?
I think the most important thing in any business is hiring good people. We've done that very well. The sporting side, I would put our coaching staff and support staff up against anybody in this country. They're outstanding, every one of them, from Gio to Carlos Llamosa, Aleko, Memo, the goalkeeper coach. Luke Sassano has really grown into his technical director position. So many people, and I'm forgetting others, but so many people are as good as you get in this country, and they've done a great job. So hiring good people is the most important thing, letting them do their job. We've tried to do that in the front office and in the sporting department. I think it's worked in a lot of ways, but it is quite a challenge here in New York. There's two other professional soccer teams here. Their budgets are much larger. Their staffing is much larger. So we're asked to be relevant in that situation with fewer people and less money. So there's a lot of sort of supporting the staff, keeping them motivated, keeping them focused, that becomes really important. You know, if we make a mistake, we feel it more than anybody else might. And then you've got all the other sports and all the other things you can do in this city.
And salary levels in this city as well that you need to compete with.
Yeah, and that's been a challenge for us. We can only afford to do so much. And, you know, the funny thing is, relative to the rest of the NASL, we have the largest staff and the highest payroll, but it doesn't compare to any of the other professional teams that are in this market, not even close. So there's a lot of work, and it's a passion project for everybody that's working with us.
Take me through a day in the life of Eric Stover. What time do you get up? What types of routines do you have? Are there any specific readings that you do every morning? And from there on, once you get into the office?
It tends to be a long day. I live in Jersey, actually, and I guess we'll get into this a little bit later. But for me, I have to get up very early, around 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm normally in the car around 6:30. Irony is I park in Harrison, New Jersey, next to Red Bull Arena, and I take the path over and subway up to Midtown. I do that about 3 or 4 days a week, 2 or 3 days a week. I'm out in Long Island doing various things. We've got a sales and marketing office there. So it's a long morning for me normally. Get in generally around 8 o'clock. And, you know, normally what I do is a cycle around soccer websites, Big Apple Soccer, Ivis, Empire Soccer, see what everybody's talking about. Same thing on social media.
What are some of the things that you keep your eyes on specifically?
It all starts with Cosmos. It all flows through us. You know, we have a legacy to live up to. And as we were just talking, we have fewer people to manage it. So I'm always very protective of that legacy. It's a privilege to work for this organization. I've gotten to know Clive Toy really well, who helped build this thing, and what his point of view was in naming the team and choosing the colors and selecting the players. And we don't want to damage that in any way. So protecting that legacy is very important, and paying attention to what people are saying about us is equally important in helping shape that public perception. It's very much out of my personality to be public person. I'd rather be behind the scenes, but this job requires it. When I was at Red Bull, it was the same thing. And interestingly enough, both organizations at Red Bull, Mr. Matyshitz, owner of the energy drink, was not forward facing at all. You know, the fans wouldn't know who he was. Seamus at the Cosmos, managing partner, is definitely out in the public more, but still pretty much behind the scenes. He's certainly not a chairman like Daniel Levy is, you know, in the front of the club at Tottenham. So for me, it's a big responsibility to look at things from the point of view of ownership and the two clubs I've worked for.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, now we're into the fourth season since the rebirth in 2013, and it's been tremendously successful, having won, you know, the championship two out of 3 years, essentially. What do you, as a club, do differently from many of the other clubs? And where I'm going with this is, regardless of how many big players you have or how good of a squad you have, it's extremely difficult to put a team together and make them succeed from day one. So are there any things that you see that you guys have done differently for it to be activated that fast and really working?
Yeah, a lot of that, the credit goes to Gio for the success. Obviously, you're the head coach. You should get credit when you win games. You certainly get the blame when you lose games. But both of us shared, we're very different people, but we shared the same vision in when we restarted this team, is that we had to live up to this legacy. And the legacy is a big help. It opens up the conversation. People, when they hear Cosmos, they're at least going to listen to you.
Yeah.
If they hear another name, they may not return the phone call. So that's a help. But then it's also a burden in having to live up to that legacy. So the way we've tried to tackle that is on an interpersonal level. You hear a lot of players, our players, talking about how it's a family, and that's not by accident. Gio is very open with them. He talks to them every day about his expectations, wants to know how they're doing with their family, what's their life like back at home if they're a foreign player, cares for them deeply. If there's a player that we have to let go for one reason or another, we're trying to help that player transition. So you hear that a lot. What Nico Kronchar, who we recently signed, I was reading some articles this morning, again, following the Cosmos news. I think it was a piece in The Guardian, and was talking about how it immediately resonated that it was a tight group and he felt welcomed and it was a family. And I've been in this sports business for 20 years, not just soccer for the last eight or so, but worked with three NFL teams, NHL, NBA, major colleges, and I've never seen anything like this organization. There's always a jerk within the team, sometimes quite a lot, difficult personalities within the front office. So for what we've been able to do is create an organization where people care for each other, and you see that on the field. I think we've gotten so many points in the last 5 minutes because there's this unified passion within the group that they don't want to let each other down, and they put it all on the line. And again, that's most of the credit goes to Gio for that.
I want to get back to what you're doing today and the Cosmos, obviously, but I want to rewind the tape and take it from the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Town of 35,000 people in the Susquehanna Valley. No one's ever heard of soccer before. That's Little League is king. Little League baseball is king.
If I want to get to know you on a more personal level, is there anything I need to know about that place?
Well, certainly it was a really safe place to grow up. You know, I had to be home when the streetlights went off and nobody had to worry about you other than that. Living here in New York's a very different place. So my growth to being able to live and survive in here was a bit of a journey. It certainly wasn't easy coming to the New Jersey, New York area for the first time. You know, small town roots, everybody sort of knew who you were. Sports was ingrained in everything we did. I played football, baseball, basketball, American football, and didn't really know anything about soccer. I didn't have any clue about the sport. I knew of the name Pelé, but didn't know anything about him, even the height of the Cosmos in the late 70s. So I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old when the Cosmos were a huge story, but they weren't in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. We knew nothing about it. So to come to the Meadowlands, start working there, start hearing the story, that's what started to light my fire for this sport.
What did your parents do for a living?
See, my mother is a office manager at a radio station, and my father, who's basically retired, but he, for most of my childhood, was in insurance. It was a pretty modest upbringing.
What's an important lesson that you've learned from your parents that's something they carry with you today?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I think I had a desire to get out of there. I went to Florida State University, just about as far away as I could go, sight unseen. So I'm not sure really where that independence came from. you know, when you grow up in a small town, it's people tend to be pretty conservative. It was very homogenous. You know, the restaurant scene wasn't too diverse.
At least you call it a scene, right?
Yeah, the big story was when Taco Bell came to town. So, you know, I'm not sure. You know, the importance of schooling and education was driven home. The of importance of competing and taking things seriously was certainly driven home. I remember I quit baseball 1 year, and you know, my father was very upset with me over it. So some of those things I learned the hard way, but they did a nice job raising me.
Did you have any specific dreams?
No, not really. You know, I wanted to be an athlete. And my problem as an athlete, I think, helped teach me how to be a better executive. I would work hard. I would get better. Basketball was my favorite sport. I would get better. People would comment on how much I grew from 1 month to two, but I didn't maintain it. So the greatest athletes in the world, when they get to a level, they don't plateau. They just keep pushing. They keep pushing. They keep pushing. So in my teens, you know, we're into, well, really late teens, and to look back on the opportunity to have played a sport in college, let's say, and I let that go because I didn't work hard enough and I wasn't determined enough to do that. While I was in college, I looked back at that and I realized I made a pretty huge mistake. Not that I had the opportunity to be a professional athlete, but when you're an athlete and you spend all day, every day doing that, and then it's gone and you realize you're never really going to get it back, you know, you're 20 years old, junior in college, whatever it is. And, you know, you look back like, I'm never going to really play for a meaningful team for a trophy ever again. You know, that was a pretty important lesson for me when I was in college. I was an advertising major. I didn't really like it. Realized that my passion was sports, and it just clicked that, all right, I'm not going to be a catcher for the New York Yankees. It's not happening. But there's jobs in sports. Someone's running the building. Someone's marketing the team. To be honest, I hadn't really thought about it. And I shifted in college and started to focus on, all right, how do I take marketing, communications, advertising, what I was learning in college, and use that as a springboard in some way to get into sports.
And what was your first job after that?
So I went to Florida State for 2 years, then Penn State. It clicked at Penn State that, you know, this revelation happened. So I got an internship at the Bryce Jordan Center at Penn State. Before it opened, it was a hole in the ground. I was working as a marketing intern. And then after graduation, trying to figure out what my next step was, and I just started looking around. I knew I wasn't a natural salesman. It's just not my personality to cold call and try to sell something. And as luck would have it, I called the Meadowlands out of nowhere looking for a job.
So you just put in like a cold call?
Yeah, just a cold call. And everything in my life changed on that call, because literally 5 minutes before I called, the director of human resources had come from a meeting, and the CEO at the Meadowlands said, we need 1,000 volunteers for the men's Final Four in 96. And I was the first person to call. And went in for an interview. Basically, it was an internship / volunteer. So it was a volunteer of volunteers. You know, I was going to help coordinate getting those 1,000 people in. Did the interview. They didn't want to hire me because they weren't going to pay me. I came from a very modest background. I had no money. And I had to convince them to give me the chance. And I lived on my credit card for a while and ran up debt. I don't advise anybody to do that, but it worked out for me.
So you made the move to Jersey somewhere?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, just picked up from State College, Pennsylvania, got in my old beat up Jeep and drove to, I think, Belleville, New Jersey. I had a studio apartment next to a hospital. Literally paid my way on a credit card, rent and food. And about, I don't know, 5-6 months into that, I got an hourly job in the arena and operations at what was Continental Airlines Arena, now Izod Center, now something they're going to tear down eventually.
And then from there on, what were the steps and like the positions that you then took within the organization?
So the first paid job, I was, hourly helping on the loading dock with deliveries and filling in on the operations side for events. It was basically the go-to person during an event to pass on a message. It wasn't any kind of management role. And then more responsibility within arena operations. Some people were out for one reason or another. I started working double shifts, doing the running an event, so a Devils game, and then running the changeover into a Nets game overnight, off that next day, and then back, So it was trial by fire. Some brilliant people, some of the best in this business, worked in that complex. It was, Giant Stadium, the arena, the racetrack. There was no busier sports complex in the world at the time, and learned a lot in a short amount of time. Moved up through arena operations, took a job in college athletics, working both buildings, Jimmy V Classic, Kickoff Classic, things like that. And then a position opened up in the stadium and went over to be sort of the right-hand man of a new general manager at Giant Stadium. Was there for 5 years at the stadium. And that's really where my love for this sport came about. But hear the stories about the Cosmos and the Rolling Stones having parties in the stadium club with jacuzzis and women and booze and everything everywhere and Studio 54. And then around that time, Charlie Stilettano had left the MetroStars, started Champions World, and started bringing big clubs to Giant Stadium. And that was the big trigger. We had Manchester United, Roma. We had sold, I think, like 40,000 tickets advance.
Around what year is this?
This is 2000, I think, somewhere right around there. And we had sold 40,000 during the lead up, and then we sold over 30,000 walk up. It was insane. People were still buying tickets and coming in and filling up the upper tier into the second half. So I saw the passion of that for the first time. And as a sport, watching Jets, Giants games, whatever, there's obviously a lot of passion. People care about it, but this was a different level. And Ruud van Nistelrooy scored an incredible goal, just insane goal. And I just was like, the best athletes in the world are playing this sport. They're not playing football, baseball, or basketball, or hockey. Best athletes around the world are playing this, and they started to pay more attention to it and watch it more. And that, not only that understanding that suddenly clicked for me as a sport to follow, it also clicked as a business. It became clear to me pretty quickly that it was eventually going to take off in this country. Mm-hmm. And when I went to San Diego to be the general manager at Qualcomm Stadium, I took that experience with me. And one of the things I'm most proud of there, we brought, the first soccer game there since the MLS All-Star game. That was a huge failure. We scheduled Mexico, Venezuela, my first year there, and that was from my MLS connections, people I knew. It's a soccer market, but mm-hmm. No one was trying anything there. And we almost sold out the stadium on a Wednesday night. Meeting was friendly. Venezuela brought their C team. And we would have sold out, but the traffic was so bad. People were parking on the highway, leaving their car and walking into the stadium. We ended up with like 62 out of 66,000. It was a great night. And it was funny for many of the writers, the typical NFL writers at, the newspapers there in San Diego, they didn't get it. Like, they were told to cover this game. They didn't get it. So if you read the articles, the first three paragraphs that they wrote before the day started was, why is this a big deal? Who cares about soccer? This is dumb. And then the stadium fills up and they're there every game for a Chargers game. And the passion of the Mexican fans and how loud that stadium was for that game. The rest of that article is, wow, this is, I get it now. I see it. I don't understand the sport yet, but what a special night. I could only imagine what a meaningful game is like. So it's been interesting because I've followed that curve of sport fan in this country that MLS, I think, was shooting for, that over time that people would start to understand it more and own it the way it's supposed to be owned and not own it through the eyes of a NFL fan or an NBA fan.
Right. After that stint, then you came back east and to the New York Red Bulls. How did that come about?
So I'm married. My wife's from North Jersey. And if we were going to leave New Jersey to go anywhere, San Diego was a great place. But I knew she wanted to come back at some point. And I got a call from a friend who said, you know, the Red Bulls are going to build a new stadium and a training facility. They're going to put a lot of money into soccer, and they're looking for somebody to help them do that. Would you consider coming back? And I said, well, sooner than I wanted to, but sure, I'd listen. So Mark de Grandpre was the managing director at the time. He reached out. We had a few good conversations. It was kind of chaotic at that point. I remember the training facility lease being signed while I was in San Diego and really just starting the conversations with Mark. And it was exciting because all this stuff, as soon as Red Bull got involved, all this stuff started to move, you know, like it was really going to happen. But it took a while. And after, I don't know, maybe 9 months of talking, I came in for interviews, and the rest is history.
What were your first impressions when you came in? Sort of in comparison to where you had been before, because you had been with, let's say, more traditional American sports with structures that had been implemented, you know, years and years back, right, and fairly established. And so what were your first impressions when you came in, and what was the first thing that you set out to do?
Well, I had an interesting background with the MetroStars and then ultimately Red Bull, because I worked running MetroStars games for 5 years. So I understood the sport much better after those 5 years. As I said, we had the biggest clubs in the world, national teams come through. I started to learn more and more about it. I started to become more of a fan. I was watching World Cup. So I had a bit of a background. And more importantly, I knew the mistakes that were happening with the MetroStars. Played a game on a Wednesday afternoon in 90 degree heat on field turf, and Jimmy Conrad literally almost died on the field. So I was there. I saw that and, you know, how the fan base reacted to those kind of decisions and some of the other mistakes that were happening. And also the challenges they had being a tenant in Giant Stadium, very much down the totem pole of who makes decisions. So
how does it work? Is it the sort of the stadium management that kind of decides on that when they get the time, or does it come from like the MLS?
No, it's the stadium management. So the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority owned the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Jets and Giants at the time were a tenant, but you know, they're the 800-pound gorilla. They chose dates, and then Giant Stadium, the management there, you know, they're going to want to fill in dates. If you can do 10 Bruce Springsteen concerts in the summer, then you're going to book the 10 Bruce Springsteen, and then the MetroStars have to schedule around that. And those kind of things in an 80,000 seat stadium, which is 10 times too big, really started to take its toll on the team. And, you know, when they started 96, 97, you know, 20, 25,000 games, pretty good. The atmosphere is okay. By the time I left and came back, it was pretty dire. I have photos of Red Bull games. The supporter section literally had 25 people in it. You could count them in the photo. And so I had that background. I saw it. I knew that the supporters had a lot of trouble with stadium security. One of the first things I did was try to fix that. I think things last couple of years in Giant Stadium got better there. But you know, when I was hired to be a vice president of operations, not run the team. And Mark resigned about a month after, Mark de Grandpre resigned about a month after I got there. And my wife was still in San Diego, and I called her. I said, okay, Mark just resigned. So 98% were fine. You know, someone will come in and, you know, I should be okay. 1% I get fired. 1% I get promoted to his job. And that was, it was probably 0.1%. And she's like, okay, okay. And eventually we sell the house, move back. During that time, 2 months goes, 3 months goes by. Red Bull eventually promotes me in the position. And, you know, that was the dream. When I started in this business, when I got that first internship, that first interview, I said to the director of HR, I said, I want to be a president of a team someday. And we eventually developed a very good friendship over time. And like when I finally started in the internship, she said, do me a favor, next time you interview for a real job, don't say you want to be a president. You sound like a little kid. And that really stuck with me because I thought, well, you know, that's what I want to do. That's my dream. I get maybe how you say it is, you know, you got to be careful with that. But that story always stuck with me. So when I got promoted into when I was promoted into Mark's position, I called, she was one of the first people I called, and I said, well, I did it. And she didn't remember the story, but.
What age were you at the time?
So 35, I think, somewhere around there.
So it's a pretty rapid rise.
Yeah, in happenstance and in the right place. And, you know, I wouldn't say it at the time because it wasn't going to get me any support, but I wasn't qualified for the position. I think I had a lot of the intangibles that were needed, but, you know, what I inherited there, it was a very volatile time. The economy went in the tank immediately. The training facility for the Red Bulls got put on the back burner. They were going to stop construction on the stadium. We had a fight with the board in Austria to keep it going. You know, understanding the pressure that, you know, when people stop buying your core product at the rate they were, everything you're doing around the world you start to, you know, have to pull back. But we had to really fight to keep the project going. And Claudio Reyna got hurt, basically didn't want to play anymore. He had to retire. We sold Josie out the door. I'll never forget my first week. I had a sit down at the Four Seasons in Manhattan. And again, I don't know anything about soccer, really. You know, I think I know a little, but for the most part, I don't really know anything about soccer. I have a sit-down meeting with Darren Dean, Father David Dean, from the board of Arsenal. He's Thierry Henry's representative, and we start talking about bringing Thierry in. And that's the first week. And I'm this kid from Williamsport, Pennsylvania, that knows nothing at the Four Seasons, starting to negotiate this contract. And, you know, that was the beginning of his first season at Barcelona, I think. So right after this huge transfer from Arsenal, it was right around that time. So all that's happening around me, and, you know, I don't have the chops for this job. I got to just fight my way through it. But we did pretty well. The team that year ended up going to the MLS Cup Championship. It was more by luck than happenstance. I guess it sort of mirrored my career. And then 2009, we were awful. I mean, really, really bad. A lot of that in defense of the coach and, sporting department was a terrible schedule because it was last year of Giant Stadium and, we play 5 games in a row on the road and then come back and squeezing four games in 3 weeks at home. It just wasn't a recipe for success. And, one thing I learned in that process is there is a fact that coaches lose locker rooms. I've never seen anything like that before or since. And unfortunately, Juan Carlos lost the locker room, and it was pretty rough. Front office, the entire, you know, the fan base. It was, I hopefully I never have to go through that again. I mean, we won before. And Red Bull wouldn't fire him. I don't know why. They just wouldn't do it. It didn't matter what we said about, you know, the locker room and the players that literally have quit. If somebody scored a goal, it was like they scored 3. The game was over. They wouldn't let us fire him, and he wanted to be fired. He actually cleared out his locker room after one game. And I, you know, I called him and said, no, you're still the coach. And eventually I convinced him to resign. You know, proud man. He didn't want to do that, but that was a way to get through the bureaucracy of what I was dealing with.
So who were making those decisions? Was it from the Red Bull HQ at that point?
Yes.
Or?
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, managing director, I have all the responsibility. I'm the only person that anybody knows. But every major decision had to run through HQ in Salzburg. And in this particular case, it was, no, you can't do it.
What was their reasoning behind
that? I have no idea. Never got an explanation. Never. And, you know, eventually I figured out that if I could convince him to resign, that that's really what he wanted. And at the end of the day, he just wanted to be paid out his contract. Not that he was quitting, but he knew there was no way back. So I was able to convince everybody that let's just do this. Richie Williams took over the team. We finished okay. Avoided the worst record in MLS history, thank God. And, you know, then a lot of things changed after that.
When you say that, you know, the coach loses the locker room, and these are things that we constantly read about in the big teams and in the media and so on, what does that really mean and how does it typically happen?
Well, it's a general lack of belief and confidence in the coach. And since I've lived through it, I've seen it around other teams now around the world. I can't imagine it was as bad as ours. You know, you have the subconscious version of this where players emotionally and intellectually want to believe that they're still playing as hard as they can and they want to win. But there's also another level to it where they maybe not intentionally sabotaging, but they're clearly not putting the effort in. And if you got them in a room one-on-one, they would say, yeah, no, I'm not working as hard. In this sport in particular, and in a competitive environment, you pull back a little bit, you're going to get eaten alive. So the watching it from the outside, Chelsea this past year was obvious.
Yeah.
Having lived through it, that he lost the locker room. For whatever reason, it was over and there was no way back. There was no series of wins that was going to repair the relationship that's required. So it can be subconscious or it can be almost sabotage. And in our case, you know, people were coming to me basically saying, you have to fire him, which I saw as a lot of disloyalty there. But there was really nothing. I was powerless to make the change until we figured out to, you know, ask him to resign. But you hear that, you hear it from players, you hear it from former coaches talking about it. It's a very, very real thing.
Yeah. And then how did you go about turning things around?
Well, you know, it was not what we needed last year of Giant Stadium going into opening Red Bull Arena. And what Red Bull decided to do was they made a lot of changes throughout soccer, their global platform. Dietmar Beiersdorfer came in, became the head of football globally. And Dietmar brought in Eric Soler to manage the sporting side. And then Eric hired Hans Bacca. So I shifted to stadium and business, not too involved with the team. A little bit, but it was mostly Eric's responsibility. And Eric ultimately reported to Didi for everything Red Bull soccer. And we lived like that for a couple of years.
You were there when the arena came up,
right?
I'm interested in, what's the process in, because it's a pretty big project in building an arena.
Well, that one's you know, a very good case study on how to get something done or not done in New Jersey politics. So Nick Sakevich was involved for a long time, you know, former MetroStars GM, AEG, and then Philadelphia Union. And for many, many years, they were trying to get clearance in New Jersey, taxpayer money to help build the stadium. At one point, it was in with a huge packet of projects, funding for an arena in Newark, funding for venues downstate. It became very bloated. And I think that, McGreevy was the governor at the time. It became so big, so much money that the whole thing collapsed and the MetroStars, AEG were left sideways. No way forward to really get this done. What changed was, and they don't get enough credit for this, Red Bull came in and said, we'll build it. We're going to pay for all of it. And at first they were going to build it to the AEG multi-purpose stadium standards, you know, concerts and all that stuff. Eventually Red Bull said, this isn't our vision, took AEG out and just plowed ahead and built it. And they put a lot of money into this thing, more than anyone percentage wise had ever done before for a venue. They paid for everything, even fronted the money for cleanup. There was a fund in New Jersey politics that if you were taking contaminated land, that if you cleaned it, you could apply for grants back to be repaid. Red Bull did that at, you know, another $15 million on top of the cost of construction. Ridiculous nuisance lawsuits from local neighbors trying to gouge them. And they really stuck through that. When I started there, it was open field and we were pouring foundations. So there a lot of people put a lot of time to get it to that point. Once you're in the ground and pouring foundations and you're going, there's really no turning back. And that's when I took over.
And was that the, in terms of location, was that the first option or?
No. And funny, when I was in San Diego, Mark had called me and was expressing reservations about the location, about the deal. There was some discussion about maybe doing a deal with the Sports Authority at the Meadowlands, find some acres there, stay there, just build a smaller stadium. And I think for Red Bull fans, that may have been a better solution. There's only so much that can get done in the location that it's at. It's very hard to get to. I go through there every day, as I said. Good to see that the path is finally being renovated. That was originally intended to be done when Red Bull Arena opened. So we're already more than 5 years past schedule. That's, I think, will be a huge help for them moving forward. There's only so many people you can carry on the path at the moment. And getting out of there on the path after a big game is difficult. When that station's done, it'll be much, much better. But if you're traveling by car, there's really not much that can be done there. But as that town builds up, which is happening, a lot of apartment buildings are going in. You'll have a little more of a pull from your local neighborhood than having to draw from, you know, Westchester, North Jersey, Central Jersey, South Jersey, even into Pennsylvania. Driving by car there is difficult. And I think for continued success, at least in the immediate term, that stadium at the Meadowlands probably would have been better. But who knows what it'll be like in 5 or 10 years, and, you know, it might flip and I'd say something different.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just in looking in retrospect, I mean, it's, And you were a big part of this in building that up in terms of attendance, sponsorships, and everything else that went into it. How did you go about really building the attendance? Because the team used to be at the very bottom,
right,
in attendance, and then ending up in the top 3, 4, 5 somewhere.
Right. So, you know, I think MLS deserves a lot of credit over the last 5 to 10 years. They've done a great job with teams on the bottom, fixing whatever's wrong and moving to the top. Probably the best example is Kansas City.
Yeah.
You know, that team, you know, minor league baseball stadium, pitcher's mound in the middle of the field. It was an embarrassment to soccer. And now you look at them and you'd say that's one of the best run organizations. For us at Red Bull, you know, that building was a sea change for the league. Everybody else was basically building glorified high school stadiums. They're, you know, stadiums in Texas football, high school football, much better than some of the first iterations of MLS soccer specific stadiums. So what Red Bull did was change everybody's point of view, and nobody would criticize that building. If you're a fan sitting in a seat, you can't do it better. So Red Bull deserves a lot of credit for that. I think the fact that, you had a real soccer venue really changed people's point of view about the team and the organization. You know, so you have that natural bump, new building, people are going to come. And then we followed up that year with bringing Thierry Henry in and Rafa Marquez in, and that was another shot in the arm for the second half of the year. So you had in the beginning, people were coming, there's a new building. And we're actually playing pretty well. And then those guys come in and there's more pomp around it, more pomp and circumstances, more excitement. And this is really happening. Finally, this team has changed, changed the way it does things. And then, so we were able to really raise, season ticket numbers to a pretty acceptable level. I think we finished the year averaging just shy of 20,000, which is a good first step. To be honest, I think, you know, I said this the first week I started with Red Bull. I thought the stadium should have been 20,000 and not 25. And then we would have had more sellouts, which would have led to more demand. I think that was a mistake and one that, you know, still paying for now. But yeah, we did pretty well. And then going into the next year, we even increased season ticket numbers more, which, you know, is unheard of. It always drops from the first year of a new building, doesn't matter the sport, to the second. But we were able to increase it, and a lot of that was bringing the MLS All-Star Game in, Manchester United. You know, we had to really, really push to get that. Everybody to agree to do that, to put a huge team in a 25,000-seat stadium, and it did a lot for our business. It really helped us pick up our season ticket number, too.
You mentioned briefly you were part of the negotiations with players such as Thierry Henry, and then Rafa Marquez was brought in as well. What are the biggest challenges when you're in such negotiation, and how does that negotiation happen?
Well, it certainly helped with Thierry because he really wanted to come to New York. And with the Cosmos now, we don't recruit and push players that don't want to be there. You don't want to be here, fine, we'll move on. So Thierry really wanted to be there. And so I carried that relationship through Darren, and we're good friends for years. Finally got to the point where his time at Barcelona was done. You know, after that first year, I remember calling Darren. I'm like, well, you just won the treble. I'm guessing he's staying at Barcelona. Yeah. We got to wait. So he had 1 year left, and again, he really wanted to come. So that helps, and you find a number that works. I didn't actually finish off the negotiation. Didi and the folks in Salzburg picked it up. I had it, you know, to a point. It was about done, and they picked it up and let them finish it. I got yelled at a few times by Darren.
For what?
It got really hard. He ended up with more money at the end, but than where I was, but he wasn't happy about the process. And for Rafa, I wasn't involved at all. The funny thing is, Didi wanted to sign Marco Senna badly. And I often wonder if we had signed Marcos, especially that point in his career, and not Rafa, what would have happened. But other folks wanted Marquez, and we ended up with Rafa, and he came in, he did well. But I wasn't involved in that deal. But also with Barcelona, another player, they wanted to move on so they could refresh the team. So being smart, picking your spot, I think helped there. And, you know, most of these players, when they're coming to the States, they have, you know, an idea of what they want. If it's about money, then you're not coming to the Cosmos, despite what people think about what we spend. Gio and I are very upfront with what we can do. And it quite often has led to conversations ending right away. And that's fine. We just, we don't want to lead a guy along thinking that he's going to get some kind of crazy money. So I think it's like any negotiation, having a strong understanding of what your point of view is and what you're willing to do, but also understanding who's on the other side of the table, have an idea what they want, and then you can find common ground most of the time.
To your point, you've been in this situation a few times, both in Red Bulls and then with the Cosmos, obviously with Marco Senna, with Raul, with that level of names. When you look at a player with a big name, how much of it is purely how good of a player he is and the fit he has to the team versus being like a marketing asset to drive attendance? And how do you find that sort of the middle point?
Well, it always has to be both, I think, if you're shooting for a player like that. But first, it has to fit who you are as a club on and off the field, your identity. And so for us with Marcos, there could not have been a better player for us to sign. It wasn't as much a marketing tool as it was a credibility tool, that we weren't messing around. We weren't coming into the NASL thinking that we're happy to be a minor league team. People just refused to believe it when the rumors started to come out that Marcos was considering us. People wrote that we were lying to him. But Marcos understood all along exactly what it was. And as I said, Gio's been the most important part of the relaunch of the Cosmos. The second most important part has been Marco Senna, because he's a great player. When he was fit with us, still an outstanding first division European player. But he came in with the right attitude. He understood that he was going to go to some stadiums that were not good. He was going to play at Hofstra on turf. And he had the right attitude all the time. And he just wanted to be a leader and he wanted to help. And, you know, probably my favorite story, the first year we went down to Tampa and the field there was awful. It was probably 6-7 inches higher at one goal than it was at the other, not exaggerating, different kinds of grass all over it. And Gio went up to him and said, you know, please just understand that this is not going to be your best day. And he stopped him. He said, I played barefoot on dirt in Sao Paulo. This is fine. I'm happy to be here, happy to help. And he carried that attitude all the way through. And you know, it wasn't talked a lot about, but he was meant to retire between the spring and fall season last year. And we had to beg him, not that he didn't want to stay, but we really needed him to stay because how important he was to the organization. And his family had already moved back to Spain, but he agreed to stay. And thank God, because we won a championship largely because of him and his leadership, a second championship. And he went out on top with his teammates lifting him up in the air. And every athlete wants that. Your last game is you're lifting a trophy. So, I can't express enough how important that guy's been to this club.
In your position today, what are your biggest challenges? Not so much as how it relates to the overall club, but specifically in what you do in your day to day.
Undoubtedly, relevance within this market and putting butts in the seats at our games. This is a fickle market. Nassau County has struggled supporting whatever teams played anywhere there. And fighting day in and day out, it's not easy. And we have to be more creative every day, try to turn over a rock we haven't turned over yet. Always be credible. And I think that's what's so important about this team is the people that have been turned on to it will tell you that this is a good soccer team and we play good soccer. We play attacking soccer. We keep the ball. We play the beautiful game. And I don't think there's enough of that in the States. So we've started to build a really loyal fan base that recognizes that. So now we just need more people, and we need it to be more consistent. We've had some great games, sold out, amazing atmosphere, playing the beautiful game and people really responding. But we haven't been consistent enough with that. And so finding a little more consistency is extremely important. And then ultimately, it's having the right building to put this team in front of people. And we're still working very hard on that.
Yeah, it's been going on for a couple of years now, right?
A lot of time. Yeah, over 3 years. And, you know, we announced it very quickly in relaunching the club before we ever kicked the ball again in the NASL. And it was a lot of hype and people were really excited about it. And now it being completely honest, it's a bit of an anchor on us. I'm not sure when this is going to air. So hopefully, there's good news by the time this does air. I feel that we're finally there. Not that I know anything, but I feel it. But it's been a burden over the last 18 months for sure. Hard to sell tickets when someone asks you about the stadium and you say, I don't know. They need to believe in your future. We've always believed in it and it's essential for our growth, but it hasn't been easy telling people, I don't know. You just don't want to be in that position.
Mm-hmm. What is the structure look like in terms of ownership and personnel?
So Seamus O'Brien's the managing partner. He has other investors in the club. Some of that is, I would say, changing but evolving as we speak, which is, I think, a good thing for us long term. And from the board level, so Seamus is the chairman, and there's representatives on the board of those other investment interests. And then I'm the next layer down. We have a senior management team of 6 or 7 people. It's a very diverse organization. I think, 3 women on our senior management team, which is, by design and kind of rare in sport.
Yeah.
I think through the front office, 1/3 of our staff are women. Again, much higher than the average percentage. And not only diversity through men and women, but diversity through culture and language. We're very representative on and off the field of the New York metropolitan area. Players from all over the world, people from all over the world. And it's a fun group to be with.
What is the business model, the revenue structure? And I guess this is fairly similar for most football clubs. What are the different verticals in terms of revenue and what's the division between those?
In our league, and really all of soccer in this country, club soccer, it's ticket sales and sponsorship. The TV money's not anywhere near where it needs to be. For us, it's non-existent. It's an actual cost at the moment. So ticket sales and sponsorship, Seamus, through his long relationship with Emirates, who's the largest, sponsor of professional sports around the world, supporting us, and a great, great partner, instant credibility. And, that's our biggest source of revenue. So it's sponsorship and ticket sales. And, you know, we're in growth mode. Basically, you know, this club's been around for 40 plus years in some form. But the last 4 years is in a lot of ways a growth mode of a startup company. So we have to put ourselves in a better position to ultimately grow the business. And that's why the stadium's so important. If, you know, TV's an economic driver. Sponsorship, ticket sales, economic driver. Well, your venue has to be an economic driver too. And at the moment, it's not. Again, another cost center. So all those things were investment spending now to try to build the club up into a position where it's stronger and more stable.
Are there any sectors that you see might be on tap? There are any opportunities that you see, and it might even be for the future? You know, in looking at, let's say, the more typical American sports, and they've been very, very good at treating them as overall commercial platforms and entertainment entities, so to speak. So is there anything that you think eventually soccer can draw from those types of experiences?
Well, globally, any sport, it's television and television money. That's the driver. And we're seeing it happen in real time right now. The Premier League is in their huge TV money is about to take an even bigger jump forward next year. And that is going to change European football completely. The advent of the Premier League and the growth of the other big leagues has put leagues like the Dutch League, Portugal, those leagues are now becoming feeder leagues.
Yeah.
And Scotland, Celtic, you know, Rangers, the relegation down four tiers for Rangers has destroyed Celtic too. And, you know, Celtic at one point was a competitor in Champions League. That'll never happen again. And they have to switch their business model to identifying talent, growing talent and selling it. You know, it wasn't that long ago where Ajax was a threat in Champions League that it's impossible now. So they've started to adapt how they live. And it's largely because the television money is being concentrated into certain leagues. I think Serie A is in a lot of trouble. I think the money that is pouring into the Premier League is going to put the big, even AC Milan, Juventus in a lot of trouble. And we saw it last year. How many of their players in the week leading up to the Champions League final were they being talked about leaving? And players always used to say, I want the chance to win at the highest level. But what you saw there was, well, you're on a great club with a huge history that's profitable. You're making good salary. Why are all you guys talking about leaving? Well, it's ultimately about money because they're going to get paid more to go somewhere else. And the concentration of wealth within certain leagues, I think is going to put other leagues in a lot of trouble. And Italy is probably for me, the next one on thin ice. So really this sport is all about TV money. Now, of course, where does streaming fit in that in the future? Where does mobile fit in that? How is that going to be consumed in the future? People are already making tactical moves to adjust to that when it happens. So, you know, the next generation growing up, they're cutting the cord. They don't necessarily have cable anymore. And cable was the driver for a long time on this TV money. So where is this money going to come from? Part of the reason that TV money is so big in sport is because it does hold people to cable. And it holds people to a specific time on a specific day. But how this all evolves over the next few years, I'm not sure, but you know, the smart money is going into certain things. And a lot of it seems to be moving towards digital and mobile content.
How would you describe your leadership style?
I'm a quiet guy in general, probably a little more intense than some folks would like.
In what sense?
Very focused, very determined. With things lately, maybe not laughing as much as people would like. It's kind of a serious environment at the moment. But I try to lead by example in putting the effort in. Again, as we discussed earlier, trusting the people that work with you, give them the tools to do what they need to do. You know, have the backbone to stand up when things aren't going well. But really, I try to give every department head the opportunity to make the decisions on their own. And for the most part, that's worked for me, whether it was at Qualcomm Stadium, at Red Bull, at Cosmos, you know, try to do that. I understand the role people need to know, have a face for the club. And so, I try to do that. I try to be very transparent with our fans. I talk openly about the decisions we make and why we make them. I get emails from them all the time. I try to respond, Twitter, whatever it is, to be engaged. I think that's extremely important. Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting over the next however many years to see how things turn and change and how we as an organization evolve.
Are there any things you do personally in order to develop and become an even better sports executive?
I do read a lot. And it's not, I'm not reading self-help books, but I read a lot. I try to learn. I've always been a good listener, and I think not the smartest guy in the world, don't have the greatest skills. But I think what I do bring to the table is I listen. So I have empathy. I always put myself in other people's point of view, whether it's a negotiation or, discipline with an employee or whatever it might be. Try to have compassion and understand. So I think that means a lot for me. I understand that that's a strength. And then I work on my weaknesses. I was a terrible public speaker when I was in college. I mean, I remember my first speech in my first speech class. It was awful. So I try to work on those things. I'm not.
How do you do it?
I practice. I started when I realized that I was awful and that I had to get in front of people and talk. One thing I started to do was tell jokes. I don't really do it anymore, but I learned a few jokes and I would tell them to friends and people because I was so shy and so quiet. It forced me to be, the center of attention for a minute or two. And I never, ever wanted to be that. Now that my job requires me to be the center of attention a lot, I don't do that as much, but I do try to come out of my shell and be more of a leader, more vocal, because this is what the job requires, but it's not natural for me. And, my weekends, I end up kind of quiet with just the family and not really wanting to do much because that's more my comfort zone.
What types of books is it that you read?
Everything. I like a lot of Eric Larson books. It finds a fascinating story. I just read Dead Wake about the sinking of the Lusitania. Finds a fascinating story, retells it in a lot of what is forgotten about it, comes alive again. Probably one of the most important books for me to understand how I want to be a leader was the Dolores Kearns Goodwin book about Lincoln, and I've drawn a blank on the name of the book, but his management style and bringing diverse opinions in and not necessarily everybody that gets along. So I do read a lot of nonfiction, try to squeeze in fiction. It's a little harder now with kids and a brutal commute to read as much as I would like, but I've learned a lot about myself and about the world around me by reading.
Are there any leaders out there that you look to or try to pick lessons from or specific learnings?
Well, I think the Lincoln book was really shaped my point of view. I think, it kind of was there in understanding that you have to lead from who you are. You can't really be fake. If you're not genuine, then people will pick up on that and they'll know. So I don't try to be overly gregarious and completely outgoing and a different person than I am. So that's important. Having diverse opinions I picked up from that book. Definitely that was an important education for me.
Do you have any mentors?
Yes. A lot of them from, my days of just getting out of college and working at the Meadowlands. Bob Castronovo was the COO there. He gave me a lot of opportunities and helped me grow and was a good leader. Ron Vandeveen he's 5 years older than me. He's now the second in command at MetLife Stadium. We were about the same age. We were sort of going through the same things. He was a little bit older. And when I started there, he had done the same thing. He was an intern, did whatever job anybody asked, worked his butt off to grow. And when I got there, he sort of saw that in me and, we've remained friends. He's always been a mentor to me. So those two jump out to me for sure. There were others there that I learned a lot from, but you kind of grow apart over time.
Who would you talk to when you need an outside reflection, not necessarily from within the organization or so?
Nowadays, it's my wife, definitely.
What does she do, by the way?
She actually very accomplished woman. She was an actress as a young child. She at four was on Sesame Street. She was in Les Mis at 11 on Broadway. Realized she didn't want to be an actress the rest of her life, and basically quit in her early teens. Didn't totally quit, but stopped chasing the commercials and the TV shows and the Broadway musicals. And she went to law school. Didn't want to be a lawyer, and went to Reed Smith, which is one of the largest law firms in the world, and helped build a marketing and events department there. Did an outstanding job. Was there for 14 years. Really underappreciated. Loved, but underappreciated. I guess you stick at one location for too long, they start to take advantage of you. And she quit about 6 months ago, something like that, and is home with the kids now. Should definitely get back to work soon. I don't think stay-at-home mom is in her DNA, but yeah, we've been a partnership from when we first met. Well, it took a while for us to get married, but we were pretty committed to each other pretty fast. And she's definitely been my rock and really helped me make the steps that I've made.
What would an example be of, say, a challenge you encountered at work that you then bring home and bring up with her?
So many. You know, at the Meadowlands, everything was going so well my first 7 years there. And then there was a change at the top. Bob Castronova was eventually, I don't want to say forced out, but he retired. And that was very volatile and difficult. And it was really, just talking it out and how to get through that. I survived. So many people were fired at that time. I survived and sort of worked my way back up there. So I do remember a lot of tough nights with her on that one. San Diego was pretty good, other than, getting there. It was the whole Enron by the sea, and mayor was forced out. I had five bosses in 6 months. So that was more emotional stability. Red Bull was a very difficult place to work. And her advice on how to manage people, how to, clear my head to manage the people that I worked with, and how to handle the folks in Austria a different way. It was a lot of stuff like that. So now it's, I guess trying to keep me from feeling like the whole world is on my shoulder trying to get this team going again, because it's not easy. It's a challenge. The Cosmos of the 70s, they were the only team in town and really the only team in the country. Well, Cruyff and George Best were here, but, the Cosmos were it and everybody looked to them. But we have two other teams with a lot more money, and we're trying to stay relevant, and that can be frustrating at times.
How do you deal with the negative buzz when people talk about, say, they talk about the MLS as the top league, you have the NASL that's obviously making a big push, not only this market, but in a few of the other markets as well.
Right.
How do you deal with, I guess, just negative buzz that sometimes comes with, and people are very opinionated without many times really knowing what's going on.
Yeah. So for me, I remember the 25 people in the supporter section at the Red Bull game.
Yeah.
So that photo pops in my mind all the time. I also look at where this league was 4 years ago. I remember going to the NASL championship game in 2012. And there were three guys that looked like they should have been playing in a pub league, totally unfit. And where it is now. And when we started this, everyone said, okay, I get the Cosmos and I kind of get trying to create an independent league, with independent clubs. That's a honorable approach. But what about all these other teams? it's not really going to happen. How could these teams stay with you? And well, they are. Tampa's done great in sort of re-envisioning itself and bringing new players in, and the growth that that team has had over the last 3 years with the new owners, tremendous. Rio, OKC, you know, they've got 5 World Cup players on their team. They haven't kicked a ball yet. I don't know how good they're going to be, but they've got good players. Jacksonville's done a great job. Indy came flying out of the gates, 10,000, 11,000 people a game, sold out. They haven't been great on the field, but, you know, the other teams are really stepping up. You can see it. So the league is much stronger. Now the competition is cutthroat, and this league's got to be serious about really being in the fight, you know, because we can't be lackadaisical about this. You got to really be competitive. It's easier in some markets because you don't have anything you're really competing against. But the league as a whole has to be fighting for survival. Not that it's on the verge of collapsing, but you have to have that point of view that if you're not growing and growing at a faster rate than your competition, then you're falling behind. So I think that's job number one right now. But where it started 4 or 5 years ago, where it is now is dramatic, dramatic improvement.
We're getting towards the end here. I know we could go on for a bit. I have a set of rapid fire questions.
Sure.
Doesn't mean that you can't spend time elaborating, if you will. What's the proudest moment or the biggest moment of your career?
You said rapid fire.
You can feel free to elaborate.
You know what? It had nothing to do with sport. It was San Diego wildfires. We had to set up Qualcomm Stadium as an evacuation center. And that was a monumental task and brought home the importance of community and family to me. And I'm not a crier, and I didn't cry, but halfway through that, day 3 or 4 of that, 3 o'clock in the morning, walking to my office to check messages, teared up a little bit.
What was it that happened? I'm sorry.
A massive wildfire as they happened in Southern California, and it caused the evacuation of 500,000 people in San Diego County, about 15,000 of which went to Qualcomm Stadium. And we set up the stadium as an evacuation center, which it, you know, really shouldn't be. It's an outdoor stadium. A lot went into that. And it was a life-changing experience. Probably the proudest moment of my career. And again, had nothing to do with kicking a ball or scoring a touchdown.
The biggest or the most interesting deal you've made?
Yeah, it's got to be Thierry. Took a long time. Created very lasting friendships out of it. I think it changed the future of the Red Bulls and MLS. And yeah, it was a pretty important moment in MLS's history and Red Bulls' history. That new stadium and that player was a defining moment.
Lifting the soccer bowl trophy again or the US Open Cup?
Well, I think because the word you said in that sentence again, it would probably be Open Cup.
The best player you've had the pleasure to work with?
Marco Senna.
What makes him so special?
You know, by the time I got to the Cosmos, I thought I understood the sport. And I've been studying again. I didn't play it, so I've had to study it and listen and learn from people. But watching him play, I learned a whole new level of the game. And I don't think fans in this market have given him enough credit. I know our fans love him and they saw it. But New York sports fans, I don't think gave him enough credit for what he's done. And the stuff I've seen him do and his understanding of the game really brought it all together for me.
What advice would you give your 20-year-old and 30-year-old self?
20. I think I got lucky. I think I wouldn't change anything. That switching my focus to sports and then making that phone call to the Meadowlands, those two things, luck, happenstance, serendipity, whatever you want to say. So I wouldn't change that. 30, you know, it's a couple of years before getting to San Diego, and there's been some tough times working for Red Bull and this Cosmos project that I've looked back and said, I could still be sitting on the back deck of the Hotel Del Coronado in San Diego, having a beer, instead of fighting this fight in New York. But yeah, I don't know that I would change much.
What are some recommendations to someone wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Well, my biggest weakness by far is I don't speak a second language, particularly in this sport. And that's a real weakness. So anybody, I used to tell people, kids coming out of college, interns, make sure you can write, articulate, you know, communicate with people, and you don't send an email and look like an idiot. That's still important, but a second language, third language, if you can get to that, you're so much more marketable globally.
You get to have dinner with three people in the football world, past or present, and let's assume language is not a barrier. Who would those three be, and where would you take them?
Well, I've been lucky enough to have dinner with Pelé a couple times, so I won't put him on the list. Let's see. I would put Clive there. And again, I've had experiences with him, but I've never been able to spend 2 or 3 hours just really, really going through Clive Toy. Mm-hmm. Really, really going through that history of the cosmos with him. I've heard a lot of it, but to spend a couple hours sharing a bottle of wine, I'd probably put Clive on there. Not sure who else. Probably Messi. Again, just to, you know, there's greatness there and understanding what drives him and how he sees things. And not because he's an athlete and I want to hang out with him, but because he is relatively quiet person on, you know, and being one of the most famous, if not the most famous athlete in the world. So trying to figure out what makes him tick and how he got to that level. Third, I don't know. This is a good question. Wish I had it in advance. Could have thought about it a little more. I don't know. I guess because he's, sort of top of mind now, Johan Cruyff, passing away recently. Because he had such a brilliant point of view about the sport, and I don't know that anybody would disagree with his ideal of where it could go. But I've also heard a lot of stories that it was a very difficult personality, and trying to understand how that makes how a guy like that ticks. You know, how can you be so beloved but then so difficult at the same time? So I think that would be interesting. It may not be a fun dinner. but I'm not sure that there's many that have changed the sport as much as Cruyff did. Again, leaving aside Pelé, because I've had that chance a couple times.
And where would you take them?
You know what? My favorite restaurant here in New York, and I haven't been in a long time, is La Paella, downtown. Don't remember the address exactly, but it's a Spanish tapas place. I spent 2 weeks in Spain and I didn't eat at a better restaurant. So I love that place, and it's very neighborhoody, cool, just natural. You sort of relax immediately when you walk in, and the sangria is very good.
How can people either get hold of you or find out more?
Well, certainly it's nycosmos.com. You want tickets or any information on us, you can find it there. For me, I'm on Twitter at Eric, E-R-I-K, Stover, Eric Stover, NYC on Twitter.
Do you have anything you would like to recommend?
That's another good question. You're hitting me with curveballs. Back to my baseball analogies. Sitting here with you, looking at your tower of books, reading. I wish I had gotten into it younger. I started in my early 20s. I only read for school. When I started to read for pleasure, it really opened up a world to me. So if you're not reading now, you should.
Last one. Who do you think I should interview?
Another good question. And I've talked a lot about him, but Giovanni's a fascinating character. I think you know him, and speaks four or five languages, plays the piano. These are things that people don't really know about him.
I had no idea he played the piano.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting music tastes. Just an all-around interesting guy. And he'll have better answers on where he would want to go. You need a recommendation on a restaurant. That guy's got them all in Manhattan for sure. But definitely Gio is a character that not enough people know on a more intimate level.
Eric, thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure. And best of luck with the season.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, subscribe to it in iTunes or on the podcast app. Please write a review. If you have any feedback or ideas, feel free to email me at sebastian@coffeeandfootball.com. You can also link up with me via Twitter. It's @coffeesfootball. Check out the coffeeandfootball.com website. There you'll find any related content and additional info on each guest. This show also lives on SoundCloud and Acast. Thanks again. Stay tuned for next week's episode. It'll go up on Monday or Tuesday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.